Ladies and gentlemen, join us now for Radio Lillooet's special presentation of Jacob Abbott's Genghis Khan.
Chapter 13 of The History of Genghis Khan. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Dion Johns, Salt Lake City, Utah. The History of Genghis Khan by Jacob Abbott. Chapter 13, Adventures of Prince Kushluk, 1203-1208. Prince Kushluk, as the reader will perhaps recollect, was the son of Tayian, the Khan of the Naimans, who organized the Grand League of Khans against Temujin at the instigation of Yemuka, as related in a preceding chapter. He was the young prince who was opposed to Jughi, the son of Temujin, in the great final battle. The reader will recollect that in that battle Tayian himself was slain, as was also Yemuka, but the young prince succeeded in making his escape. He was accompanied in his flight by a certain general or chieftain named Tukta Bey. This Tukta Bey was the Khan of a powerful tribe. The name of the town or village which he considered his capital was Kashin. It was situated towards the southwest, not far from the borders of China. Tukta Bey, taking Kushluk with him, retreated to this place, and there began to make preparations to collect a new army to act against Temujin. I say Temujin, for these circumstances took place immediately after the battle, and before Temujin had received his new title of Genghis Khan. Temujin, having learned that Tukta Bey and the young prince had gone to Kashin, determined at once to follow them there. As soon as Tukta Bey heard that he was coming, he began to strengthen the fortifications of his town and to increase the garrison. He also laid in supplies of food and military stores of all kinds. While he was making these preparations, he received the news that Temujin was advancing into his country at the head of an immense force. The force was so large that he was convinced that his town could not long stand out against it. He was greatly perplexed to know what to do. Now it happened that there was a brother of Tayian Khan's named Boyrak, the chief of a powerful horde that occupied a district of country not very far distant from Tukta Bey's dominions. Tukta Bey thought that this Boyrak would be easily induced to aid him in the war, as it was a war waged against the mortal enemy of his brother. He determined to leave his capital to be defended by the garrison which he had placed in it, and to proceed himself to Boyrak's country to obtain reinforcements. He first sent off the prince Kushluk, so that he might be as soon as possible in a place of safety. Then, after completing the necessary arrangements and dispositions for the defense of his town, in case it should be attacked during his absence, he took his oldest son, for whose safety he was also greatly concerned, and set out at the head of a small troop of horsemen to go to Boyrak. Accordingly, when Temujin, at the head of his forces, arrived at the town of Kashin, he found that the fugitives whom he was pursuing were no longer there. However, he determined to take the town. He accordingly at once invested it and commenced the siege. The garrison made a very determined resistance, but the forces under Temujin's command were too strong for them. The town was soon taken. Temujin ordered his soldiers to slay without mercy all who were found in arms against him within the walls, and the walls themselves, and all other defenses of the place, he caused to be leveled with the ground. He then issued his proclamation, offering peace and pardon to all the rest of the tribe, on condition that they would take the oath of allegiance to him. This they readily agreed to do. There were a great many subordinate khans, both of this tribe and of some others that were near, who thus yielded to Temujin and promised to obey him. All this took place, as has already been said, immediately after the great battle with Tayian, and before Temujin had been enthroned as emperor, or had received his new title of Genghis Khan. Indeed, Temujin, while making this expedition to Kashin in pursuit of Kushluk and Tukta Bey, had been somewhat uneasy at the loss of time which the campaign occasioned him, as he was anxious to go as soon as possible to Karakoram in order to take the necessary measures there for arranging and consolidating his government. He accordingly now determined not to pursue the fugitives any farther, but to proceed at once to Karakoram and postpone all farther operations against Kushluk and Tukta until the next season. So he went to Karakoram and there, during the course of the winter, formed the constitution of his new empire and made arrangements for convening a grand assembly of the Khans the next spring, as related in the last chapter. In the meantime, Tukta Bey and the Prince Kushluk were very kindly received by Boyrak, Tayian's brother. For a time, they all had reason to expect that Temujin, after having taken and destroyed Kashin, would continue his pursuit of the prince, and Boyrak began accordingly to make preparations for defense. But when, at length, they learned that Temujin had given up the pursuit and had returned to Karakoram, their apprehensions were, for the moment, relieved. They were, however, well aware that the danger was only postponed, and Boyrak, being determined to defend the cause of his nephew, and to avenge, if possible, his brother's death, occupied himself diligently with increasing his army, strengthening his fortifications, and providing himself with all possible means of defense against the attack which he expected would be made upon him in the coming season. Boyrak's expectations of an attack were fully realized. Temujin, after having settled the affairs of his government and having now become Genghis Khan, took the first opportunity in the following season to fit out an expedition against Tukta Bey and Boyrak. He marched into Boyrak's dominions at the head of a strong force. Boyrak came forth to meet him. A great battle was fought. Boyrak was entirely defeated. When he found that the battle was lost, he attempted to fly. He was, however, pursued and taken, and was then brought back to the camp of Genghis Khan, where he was put to death. The conqueror undoubtedly justified this act of cruelty toward his helpless prisoner on the plea that, like Yemuka, he was not an open and honorable foe, but a rebel and traitor, and consequently that the act of putting him to death was the execution of a criminal and not the murder of a prisoner. But although Boyrak himself was thus taken and slain, Kushluk and Tukta Bey succeeded in making their escape. They fled to the northward and westward, scarcely knowing, it would seem, where they were to go. They at last found a place of refuge on the banks of the river Irtysh. This river rises not far from the center of the Asiatic continent and flows northward into the Northern Ocean. The country through which it flows lay to the northwestward of Genghis Khan's dominions and beyond the confines of it. Through this country, Prince Kushluk and Tukta Bey wandered on, accompanied by the small troop of followers that still adhered to them, until they reached a certain fortress called Irtysh, where they determined to make a stand. They were among friends here, for Irtysh, it seems, was on the confines of territory that belonged to Tukta Bey. The people of the neighborhood immediately flocked to Tukta's standard, and thus the fugitive Khan soon found himself at the head of a considerable force. This force was farther increased by the coming in of broken bands that had made their escape from the battle at which Boyrak had been slain at the same time with Tukta Bey, but had become separated from him in their flight. It would seem that, at first, Genghis Khan did not know what was become of the fugitives. At any rate, it was not until the next year that he attempted to pursue them. Then, hearing where they were and what they were doing, he prepared an expedition to penetrate into the country of the Irtysh and attack them. It was in the dead of winter when he arrived in the country. He had hurried on at that season of the year in order to prevent Tukta Bey from having time to finish his fortifications. Tukta Bey and those who were with him were amazed when they heard that their enemy was coming at that season of the year. The defenses which they were preparing for their fortress were not fully completed, but they were at once convinced that they could not hold their ground against the body of troops that Genghis Khan was bringing against them in the open field, and so they all took shelter in and near the fortress and awaited their enemy there. The winters in that latitude are very cold, and the country through which Genghis Khan had to march was full of difficulty. The branches of the river which he had to cross were obstructed with ice, and the roads were in many places rendered almost impassable by snow. The emperor did not even know the way to the fortress where Tukta Bey and his followers were concealed, and it would have been almost impossible for him to find it had it not been for certain tribes, through whose territories he passed on the way, who furnished him with guides. These tribes, perceiving how overwhelming was the force which Genghis Khan commanded, knew that it would be useless for them to resist him. So they yielded submission to him at once, and detached parties of horsemen to go with him down the river to show him the way. Under the conduct of these guides, Genghis Khan passed on. In due time he arrived at the fortress of Ardish, and immediately forced Tukta Bey and his allies to come to an engagement. Tukta's army was very soon defeated and put to flight. Tukta himself and many other Khans and chieftains who had joined him were killed. But the Prince Kushluk was once more fortunate enough to make his escape. He fled with a small troop of followers, all mounted on fleet horses, and after various wanderings, in the course of which he and those who were with him endured a great deal of privation and suffering, the unhappy fugitive at last reached the dominions of a powerful prince named Gurkhan, who reigned over a country which is situated in the western part of Asia, toward the Caspian Sea, and is named Turkestan. This is the country from which the people called the Turks, who afterwards spread themselves so widely over the western part of Asia and the eastern part of Europe, originally sprung. Gurkhan received Kushluk and his party in a very friendly manner, and Genghis Khan did not follow them. Whether he thought that the distance was too great, or that the power of Gurkhan was too formidable to make it prudent for him to advance into his dominions without a stronger force, does not appear. At any rate, for the time being, he gave up the pursuit, and after fully securing the fruits of the victory which he had gained at Ardish, and receiving the submission of all the tribes and Khans that inhabited that region of country, he set out on his return home. It is related that one of the Khans who gave in his submission to Genghis Khan at this time made him a present of a certain bird called a shongar, according to a custom often observed among the people of that region. The shongar was a very large and fierce bird of prey, which, however, could be trained like the falcons which were so much prized in the Middle Ages by the princes and nobles of Europe. It seems it was customary for an inferior Khan to present one of these birds to his superior on great occasions as an emblem and token of his submission to his superior's authority. The bird in such a case was very richly decorated with gold and precious stones, so that the present was sometimes of a very costly and magnificent character. Genghis Khan received such a present as this from a chieftain named Ursus Inal, who was among those that yielded to his sway in the country of the Irtysh, after the battle at which Tukta Bey was defeated and killed. The bird was presented to Genghis Khan by Urus with great ceremony, as an act of submission and homage. What, in the end, was the fate of Prince Kushluk will appear in the next chapter. End of chapter 13. Chapter 14. Itakut, 1208. Itakut, the old system of farming revenues. Evils of farming the revenue. There was another great and powerful Khan named Itakut, whose tribe had hitherto been under the dominion of Gurkhan, the prince of Turkestan, where Kushluk had sought refuge, but who about this time revolted from Gurkhan and went over to Genghis Khan, under circumstances which illustrate in some degree the peculiar nature of the political ties by which these different tribes and nations were bound to each other. It seems that the tribe over which Idikut ruled was tributary to Turkestan, and that Gurkhan had an officer stationed in Idikut's country whose business it was to collect and remit the tribute. The name of this collector was Shuwakem. He was accustomed, it seems, like almost all tax gatherers in those days, to exact more than was his due. The system generally adopted by governments in that age of the world for collecting their revenues from tributary or conquered provinces was to farm them, as the phrase was. That is, they sold the whole revenue of a particular district in the gross to some rich man, who paid for it a specific sum, considerably less, of course, than the tax itself would really yield, and then he reimbursed himself for his outlay and for his trouble by collecting the tax in detail from the people. Of course, it was for the interest of the tax gatherer in such a case, after having paid the round sum to the government, to extort as much as possible from the people, since all that he obtained over and above the sum that he had paid was his profit on the transaction. Then, if the people complained to the government of his exactions, they could seldom obtain any redress, for the government knew that if they rebuked or punished the farmer of the revenue, or interfered with him in any way, they would not be able to make so favorable terms with him for the next year. Modern system. Disinterested collectors. Independent and impartial courts. Waste of the public money. The plan of farming the revenues thus led to a great deal of extortion and oppression, which the people were compelled patiently to endure, as there was generally no remedy. In modern times and among civilized nations, this system has been almost universally abandoned. The taxes are now always collected for the government directly by officers who have to pay over not a fixed sum, but simply what they collect. Thus, the tax gatherers are, in some sense, impartial, since if they collect more than the law entitles them to demand, the benefit inures almost wholly to the government, they themselves gaining little or no advantage by their extortion. Besides this, there are courts established which are, in a great measure, independent of the government, to which the taxpayer can appeal at once in a case where he thinks he is aggrieved. This, it is true, often puts him to a great deal of trouble and expense, but in the end he is pretty sure to have justice done him, while under the old system there was ordinarily no remedy at all. There was nothing to be done but to appeal to the king or chieftain himself, and these complaints seldom received any attention, for besides the natural unwillingness of the sovereign to trouble himself about such disputes, he had a direct interest in not requiring the extorted money to be paid back, or rather in not having it proved that it was extorted. Thus the poor taxpayer found that the officer who collected the money and the umpire who was to decide in case of disputes were both directly interested against him, and he was continually wronged. Whereas at the present day, by means of a system which provides disinterested officers to determine and collect the tax, and independent judges to decide all cases of dispute, the evils are almost wholly avoided. The only difficulty now is the extravagance and waste with which the public money is expended, making it necessary to collect a much larger amount than would otherwise be required. Perhaps some future generation will discover some plain and simple remedy for this evil, too. Shuwakem. The name of the officer who had the general charge of the collection of the taxes in Idikut's territory for Gurkhan, king of Turkestan, was, as has already been said, Shuachim. He oppressed the people, exacting more from them than was really due. Whether he had farmed the revenue, and was thus enriching himself by his extortions, or whether he was acting directly in Gurkhan's name, and made the people pay more than he ought from zeal in his master's service, and a desire to recommend himself to favor by sending home to Turkestan as large a revenue from the provinces as possible, does not appear. At all events, the people complained bitterly. They had, however, no access to Gurkhan, Shuachim's master, and so they carried their complaints to Itakut, their own khan. Itakut's quarrel with Gurkhan's tax gatherers. Itakut remonstrated with Shuachim, but he, instead of taking the remonstrance in good part and relaxing the severity of his proceedings, resented the interference of Itakut, and answered him in a haughty and threatening manner. This made Itakut very angry. Indeed, he was angry before, as it might naturally be supposed that he would have been, at having a person owing allegiance to a foreign prince exercising authority in a proud and domineering manner within his dominions. And the reply which Shuachim made when he remonstrated with him on account of his extortions exasperated him beyond all bounds. He immediately caused Shuachim to be assassinated. He also slew all the other officers of Gurkhan within his country, those probably who were employed to assist Shuachim in collecting the taxes. Rebellion. He sends to Genghis Khan. The murder of these officers was, of course, an act of open rebellion against Gurkhan, and Itakut, in order to shield himself from the consequences of it, determined to join himself and his tribe at once to the empire of Genghis Khan. So he immediately dispatched 2 ambassadors to the Mongol emperor with his proposals. The envoys, accompanied by a suitable troop of guards and attendants, went into the Mongol country and presently came up with Genghis Khan, while he was on a march toward the country of some tribe or horde that had revolted from him. They were very kindly received, for although Genghis Khan was not prepared at present to make open war upon Gurkhan or to invade his dominions in pursuit of Prince Kushluk, he was intending to do this at some future day, and in the meantime he was very glad to weaken his enemy by drawing off from his empire any tributary tribes that were at all disposed to revolt from him. His reception of the embassy. He accordingly received the ambassadors of Itakut in a very cordial and friendly manner. He readily acceded to the proposals which Itakut made through them, and in order to give full proof to Itakut of the readiness and sincerity with which he accepted his proposals, he sent back 2 ambassadors of his own to accompany Itakut's ambassadors on their return, and to join them in assuring that prince of the cordiality with which Genghis Khan accepted his offers of friendship, and to promise his protection. Itakut's visit to Genghis Khan. Itakut was very much pleased, when his messengers returned, to learn that his mission had been so successful. He immediately determined to go himself and visit Genghis Khan in his camp, in order to confirm the new alliance by making a personal tender to the emperor of his homage and his services. He accordingly prepared some splendid presents, and placing himself at the head of his troop of guards, he proceeded to the camp of Genghis Khan. The emperor received him in a very kind and friendly manner. He accepted his presents, and in the end was so much pleased with Itakut himself that he gave him one of his daughters in marriage. Gurkhan in a rage. As for Gurkhan, when he first heard of the murder of Shuachim and the other officers, he was in a terrible rage. He declared that he would revenge his servant by laying waste Itakut's territories with fire and sword. But when he heard that Itakut had placed himself under the protection of Genghis Khan, and especially when he learned that he had married the emperor's daughter, he thought it more prudent to postpone his vengeance, not being quite willing to draw upon himself the hostility of so great a power. Subsequent History of Kushluk, Jena. Prince Kushluk remained for many years in Turkestan and in the countries adjoining it. He married a daughter of Gurkhan, his protector, partly in consequence of this connection and of the high rank which he had held in his own native land, and partly, perhaps, in consequence of his personal courage and other military qualities, he rapidly acquired great influence among the Khans of Western Asia, and at last he organized a sort of rebellion against Gurkhan, made war against him, and deprived him of more than half his dominions. He then collected a large army and prepared to make war upon Genghis Khan. Genghis Khan sent one of his best generals at the head of a small but very compact and well-disciplined force against him. The name of this general was Jena. Kushluk was not at all intimidated by the danger which now threatened him. His own army was much larger than that of Jena, and he accordingly advanced to meet his enemy without fear. He was, however, beaten in the battle, and when he saw that the day was lost, he fled, followed by a small party of horsemen, who succeeded in saving themselves with him. Kushluk's final defeat and flight, hotly pursued by Jena. Jena set out immediately in pursuit of the fugitive, accompanied by a small body of men mounted on the fleetest horses. The party who were with Kushluk, being exhausted by the fatigue of the battle and bewildered by the excitement and terror of their flight, could not keep together, but were overtaken one by one and slain by their pursuers until only three were left. These three kept close to Kushluk and with him went on until Jena's party lost the track of them. At length, coming to a place where two roads met, Jena asked a peasant if he had seen any strange horsemen pass that way. The peasant said that four horsemen had passed a short time before, and he told Jena which road they had taken. Kushluk's death. Jena and his party rode on in that direction which the peasant had indicated, and pushing forward with redoubled speed, they soon overtook the unhappy fugitives. They fell upon Kushluk without mercy and killed him on the spot. They then cut off his head and turned back to carry it to Genghis Khan. Genghis Khan's triumph. Genghis Khan rewarded Jena in the most magnificent manner for his successful performance of this exploit, and then, putting Kushluk's head upon a pole, he displayed it in all the camps and villages through which he passed, where it served at once as a token and a trophy of his victory against an enemy, and at the same time as a warning to all other persons of the terrible danger which they would incur in attempting to resist his power. End of chapter 14.
Imagine a place where raw natural beauty combines with insight, entertainment, and information. Step through that door with me now. This is Radio Lillooet 100.5 FM.
Chapter 15, The Story of Hujaku, 1211. China, the Chinese Wall. The accounts given us of the events and transaction of Genghis Khan's reign after he acquired the supreme power over the Mongol and Tartar nations are imperfect and in many respects confused. It appears, however, from them that in the year 1211, that is about 5 years after his election as Grand Khan, he became involved in a war with the Chinese, which led in the end to very important consequences. The kingdom of China lay to the southward of the Mongol territories, and the frontier was defended by the famous Chinese Wall, which extended from east to west, over hills and valleys, from the great desert to the sea, for many hundred miles. The wall was defended by towers, built here and there in commanding positions along the whole extent of it, and at certain distances there were fortified towns where powerful garrisons were stationed. and reserves of troops were held ready to be marched to different points along the wall wherever there might be occasion for their services. The frontier. The wall was not strictly the Chinese frontier, for the territory on the outside of it, to a considerable distance, was held by the Chinese government, and there were many large towns and some very strong fortresses in this outlying region, all of which were held and garrisoned by Chinese troops. Outside the wall. The inhabitants, however, of the countries outside the wall were generally of the Tartar or Mongol race. They were of a nation or tribe called the Khitan, and were somewhat inclined to rebel against the Chinese rule. In order to assist in keeping them in subjection, one of the Chinese emperors issued a decree which ordained that the governors of those provinces should place in all the large towns and other strongholds outside the wall twice as many families of the Chinese as there were of the Khitan. This regulation greatly increased the discontent of the Khitan and made them more inclined to rebellion than they were before. Origin of the quarrel with the Chinese, Yangtze. Besides this, there had been for some time a growing difficulty between the Chinese government and Genghis Khan. It seems that the Mongols had been for a long time accustomed to pay some sort of tribute to the Emperor of China, and many years before, while Genghis Khan, under the name of Temujin, was living at Karakoram, a subject of Vang Khan, the Emperor sent a certain royal prince named Yangtze to receive what was due. While Yangtze was in the Mongol territory, he and Temujin met, but they did not agree together at all. The Chinese prince put some slight upon Temujin, which Temujin resented. Very likely, Temujin, whose character at that time, as well as afterward, was marked with a great deal of pride and spirit, opposed the payment of the tribute. At any rate, Yangtze became very much incensed against him, and on his return made serious charges against him to the emperor, and urged that he should be seized and put to death. But the emperor declined engaging in so dangerous an undertaking. Yangtze's proposal, however, became known to Temujin, and he secretly resolved that he would one day have his revenge. At length, about 3 or 4 years after Temujin was raised to the throne, the emperor of the Chinese died, and Yangtze succeeded him. The very next year, he sent an officer to Genghis Khan to demand the usual tribute. When the officer came into the presence of Genghis Khan in his camp and made his demand, Genghis Khan asked him who was the emperor that had sent him with such a message. The officer replied that Yangtze was at that time emperor of the Chinese. Genghis Khan's contempt for him. Yangtze, repeated Genghis Khan in a tone of great contempt. The Chinese have a proverb, he added, that such a people as they ought to have a god for their emperor, but it seems they do not know how to choose even a decent man. It was true that they had such a proverb. They were as remarkable, it seems, in those days as they are now for their national self-importance and vanity. Go and tell your emperor, added Genghis Khan, that I am a sovereign ruler and that I will never acknowledge him as my master. Armies raised. Hujaku. When the messenger returned with this defiant answer, Yangtze was very much enraged and immediately began to prepare for war. Genghis Khan also at once commenced his preparations. He sent envoys to the leading khans who occupied the territories outside the wall, inviting them to join him. He raised a great army and put the several divisions of it under the charge of his ablest generals. Yangtze raised a great army too. The historians say that it amounted to 300,000 men. He put this army under the command of a great general named Hujaku, and ordered him to advance with it to the northward so as to intercept the army of Genghis Khan on its way and to defend the wall and the fortresses on the outside of it from his attacks. Many of the khans come over on Genghis's side. In the campaign which ensued, Genghis Khan was most successful. The Mongols took possession of a great many towns and fortresses beyond the wall, and every victory that they gained made the tribes and nations that inhabited those provinces more and more disposed to join them. Many of them revolted against the Chinese authority and turned to their side. One of these was a chieftain so powerful that he commanded an army of 100,000 men. In order to bind himself solemnly to the covenant which he was to make with Genghis Khan, he ascended a mountain in company with the envoy and with others who were to witness the proceedings, and there performed the ceremony customary on such occasions. The ceremony consisted of sacrificing a white horse and a black ox, and then breaking an arrow, at the same time pronouncing an oath by which he bound himself, under the most solemn sanctions, to be faithful to Genghis Khan. To reward the prince for this act of adhesion to his cause, Genghis Khan made him king over all that portion of the country, and caused him to be everywhere so proclaimed. This encouraged a great many other khans and chieftains to come over to his side, and at length one who had the command of one of the gates of the great wall and of the fortress which defended it joined him. By this means, Genghis Khan obtained access to the interior of the Chinese dominions, and Yang Si and his great general Hujaku became seriously alarmed. Victory over Hujaku. At length, after various marchings and counter-marchings, Genghis Khan learned that Hujaku was encamped with the whole of his army in a very strong position at the foot of a mountain, and he determined to proceed thither and attack him. He did so, and the result of the battle was that Hujaku was beaten and was forced to retreat. He retired to a great fortified town, and Genghis Khan followed him and laid siege to the town. Hujaku, finding himself in imminent danger, fled, and Genghis Khan was on the point of taking the town when he was suddenly stopped in his career by being one day wounded severely by an arrow which was shot at him from the wall. Genghis Khan is wounded. The wound was so severe that, while suffering under it, Genghis Khan found that he could not successfully direct the operations of the army, and so he withdrew his troops and retired into his own country to wait there until his wound should be healed. In a few months, he was entirely recovered, and the next year he fitted out a new expedition and advanced again into China. Hujaku disgraced. In the meantime, Hujaku, who had been repeatedly defeated and driven back the year before by Genghis Khan, had fallen into disgrace. His rivals and enemies, among the other generals of the army and among the officers of the court, conspired against him and represented to the emperor that he was unfit to command, and that his having failed to defend the towns and the country that had been committed to him was owing to his cowardice and incapacity. In consequence of these representations, Hujaku was cashiered, that is, dismissed from his command in disgrace. Restored again. This made him very angry, and he determined that he would have his revenge. There was a large party in his favor at court, as well as a party against him, and after a long and bitter contention, the former once more prevailed and induced the emperor to restore Hujaku to his command again. Dissensions among the Chinese. The quarrel, however, was not ended, and so, when Genghis Khan came the next year to renew the invasion, the councils of the Chinese were so distracted and their operations so paralyzed by this feud that he gained very easy victories over them. The Chinese generals, instead of acting together in a harmonious manner against the common enemy, were intent only on the quarrel which they were waging against each other. At length, the animosity proceeded to such an extreme that Hujaku resolved to depose the emperor, who seemed inclined rather to take part against him, assassinate all the chiefs of the opposite party, and then finally to put the emperor to death, and cause himself to be proclaimed in his stead. advance of the Mongols. In order to prepare the way for the execution of this scheme, he forbore to act vigorously against Genghis Khan and the Mongols, but allowed them to advance farther and farther into the country. This, of course, increased the general discontent and excitement, and prepared the way for the revolt which Hujaku was plotting. Hujaku's Rebellion. Death of Yang Si. At length the time for action arrived. Hujaku suddenly appeared at the head of a large force at the gates of the capital, and gave the alarm that the Mongols were coming. He pressed forward into the city to the palace, and gave the alarm there. At the same time, files of soldiers, whom he had ordered to this service, went to all parts of the city, arresting and putting to death all the leaders of the party opposed to him, under pretense that he had discovered a plot or conspiracy in which they were engaged to betray the city to the enemy. The excitement and confusion which was produced by this charge, and by the alarm occasioned by the supposed coming of the Mongols, so paralyzed the authorities of the town that nobody resisted Hujaku, or attempted to save the persons whom he arrested. Some of them he caused to be killed on the spot. Others he shut up in prison. Finding himself thus undisputed master of the city, he next took possession of the palace, seized the emperor, deposed him from his office, and shut him up in a dungeon. Soon afterward, he put him to death. This was the end of Yang Si, but Hujaku did not succeed, after all, in his design of causing himself to be proclaimed emperor in his stead. He found that there would be very great opposition to this, and so he gave up this part of his plan, and finally raised a certain prince of the royal family to the throne, while he retained his office of commander-in-chief of the forces. Having thus, as he thought, effectually destroyed the influence and power of his enemies at the capital, he put himself once more at the head of his troops, and went forth to meet Genghis Khan. Hujaku advances. Some accident happened to him about this time, by which his foot was hurt, so that he was in some degree disabled, but still he went on. At length he met the vanguard of Genghis Khan's army at a place where they were attempting to cross a river by a bridge. Hujaku determined immediately to attack them. The state of his foot was such that he could not walk or even mount a horse, but he caused himself to be put upon a sort of car, and was by this means carried into the battle. The battle. Hujaku's victory. The Mongols were completely defeated and driven back. Perhaps this was because Genghis Khan was not there to command them. He was at some distance in the rear with the main body of the army. Hujaku was very desirous of following up his victory by pursuing and attacking the Mongol vanguard the next day. He could not, however, do this personally, for on account of the excitement and exposure which he had endured in the battle, and the rough movements and joltings which, notwithstanding all his care, he had to bear in being conveyed to and fro about the field, his foot grew much worse. Inflammation set in during the night, and the next day the wound opened afresh, so he was obliged to give up the idea of going out himself against the enemy, and to send one of his generals instead. The general to whom he gave the command was named Khan Ki. Khan Ki's expedition. Failure. Hujaku enraged. Khan Ki went out against the enemy, but after a time returned unsuccessful. Hujaku was very angry with him when he came to hear his report. Perhaps the wound in his foot made him impatient and unreasonable. At any rate, he declared that the cause of Khan Ki's failure was his dilatoriness in pursuing the enemy, which was cowardice or treachery, and in either case he deserved to suffer death for it. He immediately sent to the emperor a report of the case, asking that the sentence of death which he had pronounced against Khan Ki might be confirmed, and that he might be authorized to put it into execution. But the emperor, knowing that Khan Ki was a courageous and faithful officer, would not consent. In the meanwhile,
Before the emperor's answer came back, the wrath of Hujaku had had time to cool a little. Accordingly, when he received the answer, he said to Kanki that he would, after all, try him once more. "Take the command of the troops again," said he, "and go out against the enemy. If you beat them, I will overlook your first offense and spare your life. But if you are beaten yourself a second time, you shall die." Kanki's second trial, the sandstorm. So Kanki placed himself at the head of his detachment and went out again to attack the Mongols. They were to the northward and were posted, it seems, upon or near a sandy plain. At any rate, a strong north wind began to blow at the time when the attack commenced and blew the sand and dust into the eyes of his soldiers so that they could not see, while their enemies, the Mongols, having their backs to the wind, were very little incommoded. The result was that Kanki was repulsed with considerable loss and was obliged to make the best of his way back to Hujaku's quarters to save the remainder of his men. Kanki's desperate resolution. He now was desperate. Hujaku had declared that if he came back without having gained a victory, he should die, and he had no doubt that the man was violent and reckless enough to keep his word. He determined not to submit. He might as well die fighting, he thought, at the head of his troops, as to be ignobly put to death by Hujaku's executioner. So he arranged it with his troops, who probably hated Hujaku as much as he did, that on returning to the town, they should march in under arms, take possession of the place, surround the palace, and seize the general and make him prisoner, or kill him if he should attempt any resistance. The attack, Hujaku's flight. He is killed in the gardens. The troops, accordingly, when they arrived at the gates of the town, seized and disarmed the guards, and then marched in, brandishing their weapons, and uttering loud shouts and outcries, which excited first a feeling of astonishment and then of terror among the inhabitants. The alarm soon spread to the palace. Indeed, the troops themselves soon reached and surrounded the palace and began thundering at the gates to gain admission. They soon forced their way in. Hujaku, in the meantime, terrified and panic-stricken, had fled from the palace into the gardens in hopes to make his escape by the garden walls. The soldiers pursued him. In his excitement and agitation, he leaped down from a wall too high for such a descent, and in the fall broke his leg. He lay writhing helplessly on the ground when the soldiers came up. They were wild and furious with the excitement of pursuit, and they killed him with their spears where he lay. Kanki took the head of his old enemy and carried it to the capital, with the intention of offering it to the emperor and also of surrendering himself to the officers of justice, in order, as he said, that he might be put to death for the crime of which he had been guilty in heading a military revolt and killing his superior officer. By all the laws of war, this was a most heinous and a wholly unpardonable offense. Kanki is pardoned and promoted. But the emperor was heartily glad that the turbulent and unmanageable old general was put out of the way, for a man so unprincipled, so ambitious, and so reckless as Hujaku was, is always an object of aversion and terror to all who have anything to do with him. The emperor accordingly issued a proclamation in which he declared that Hujaku had been justly put to death in punishment for many crimes which he had committed, and soon afterward he appointed Kanki commander-in-chief of the forces in his stead. End of chapter 15. Chapter 16, Conquests in China, 1211 to 1216. War continued. Rich and fertile country. Grand invasion. Simultaneous attack by four armies. After the death of Hujaku, the emperor of China endeavored to defend his dominions against Genghis Khan by means of his other generals, and the war was continued for several years, during which time Genghis Khan made himself master of all the northern part of China, and ravaged the whole country in the most reckless and cruel manner. The country was very populous and very rich. The people, unlike the Mongols and Tartars, lived by tilling the ground, and they practiced in great perfection many manufacturing and mechanic arts. The country was very fertile, and in the place of the boundless pasturages of the Mongol territories, it was covered in all directions with cultivated fields, gardens, orchards, and mulberry groves, while thriving villages and busy towns were scattered over the whole face of it. It was to protect this busy hive of wealth and industry that the Great Wall had been built ages before, for the Chinese had always been stationary, industrious, and peaceful, while the territories of Central Asia, lying to the north of them, had been filled from time immemorial with wild, roaming, and unscrupulous troops of marauders, like those who were now united under the banner of Genghis Khan. The wall had afforded for some hundreds of years an adequate protection, for no commander had appeared of sufficient power to organize and combine the various hordes on a scale great enough to enable them to force so strong a barrier. But now that Genghis Khan had come upon the stage, the barrier was broken through, and the terrible and reckless hordes poured in with all the force and fury of an inundation. In the year 1214, which was the year following that in which Hujaku was killed, Genghis Khan organized a force so large for the invasion of China that he divided it into four different battalions, which were to enter by different roads and ravage different portions of the country. Each of these divisions was by itself a great and powerful army, and the simultaneous invasion of four such masses of reckless and merciless enemies filled the whole land with terror and dismay. Enthusiasm of the troops. The Chinese emperor sent the best bodies of troops under his command to guard the passes in the mountains and the bridges and fording places on the rivers, hoping in this way to do something towards stemming the tide of these torrents of invasion. But it was all in vain. Genghis Khan had raised and equipped his forces by means, in a great measure, of the plunder which he had obtained in China the year before, and he had made great promises and glowing representations to his men in respect to the booty to be obtained in this new campaign. The troops were consequently full of ardor and enthusiasm, and they pressed on with such impetuosity as to carry all before them. Captives, immense plunder. The Emperor of China, in pursuing his measures of defense, had ordered all the men capable of bearing arms in the villages and in the open country to repair to the nearest large city or fortress, there to be enrolled and equipped for service. The consequence was that the Mongols found in many places, as they advanced through the country, nobody but infirm old men and women and children in the hamlets and villages. A great many of these, especially such as seemed to be of most consequence, the handsomest and best of the women and the oldest children, they seized and took with them in continuing their march, intending to make slaves of them, and also of all the silks and other rich and valuable merchandise which they found, and distributed it as plunder. The spoil which they obtained, too, in sheep and cattle, was enormous. From it they made up immense flocks and herds, which were driven off into the Mongol country. The rest were slaughtered and used to supply the army with food. Dreadful ravages. It was the custom of the invaders, after having pillaged a town and its environs, and taken away all which they could convert to any useful purpose for themselves, to burn the town itself, and then to march on, leaving in the place only a smoking heap of ruins, with the miserable remnant of the population which they had spared, wandering about the scene of desolation in misery and despair. Base use made of the captives. They made a most cowardly and atrocious use, too, of the prisoners whom they conveyed away. When they arrived at a fortified town, where there was a garrison or any other armed force prepared to resist them, they would bring forward these helpless captives and put them in the forefront of the battle in such a manner that the men on the walls could not shoot their arrows at their savage assailants without killing their own wives and children. The officers commanded the men to fire, notwithstanding. But they were so moved by the piteous cries which the women and children made that they could not bear to do it, and so they refused to obey. And in the excitement and confusion thus produced, the Mongols easily obtained possession of the town. Extent of Mongol Conquests. There are two great rivers in China, both of which flow from west to east, and they are at such a distance from each other and from the frontiers that they divide the territory into three nearly equal parts. The northernmost of these rivers is the Wang Ho. The Mongols, in the course of 2 years, overran and made themselves masters of almost the whole country lying north of this river, that is, of about one-third of China proper. There were, however, some strongly fortified towns which they found it very difficult to conquer. The Siege of Yanqing. Among other places, there was the imperial city of Yanqing, where the emperor himself resided, which was so strongly defended that for some time the Mongols did not venture to attack it. At length, however, Genghis Khan came himself to the place and concentrated there a very large force. The emperor and his court were very much alarmed, expecting an immediate assault. Still, Genghis Khan hesitated. Some of his generals urged him to scale the walls and so force his way into the city, but he thought it more politic to adopt a different plan. Proposed terms of arrangement. So he sent an officer into the town with proposals of peace to be communicated to the emperor. In these proposals, Genghis Khan said that he himself was inclined to spare the town, but that to appease his soldiers, who were furious to attack and pillage the city, it would be necessary to make them considerable presents, and that if the emperor would agree to such terms with him as should enable him to satisfy his men in this respect, he would spare the city and would retire. Difference of opinion. The emperor and his advisers were much perplexed at the receipt of this proposal. There was great difference of opinion among the counselors in respect to the reply which was to be made to it. Some were in favor of rejecting it at once. One general, not content with a simple rejection of it, proposed that, to show the indignation and resentment which they felt in receiving it, the garrison should march out of the gates and attack the Mongols in their camp. Consultation on the subject. There were other ministers, however, who urged the emperor to submit to the necessity of the case and make peace with the conqueror. They said that the idea of going out to attack the enemy in their camp was too desperate to be entertained for a moment, and if they waited within the walls and attempted to defend themselves there, they exposed themselves to a terrible danger without any countervailing hope of advantage at all commensurate with it. For if they failed to save the city, they were all utterly and irretrievably ruined, and if, on the other hand, they succeeded in repelling the assault, it was only a brief respite that they could hope to gain, for the Mongols would soon return in greater numbers and in a higher state of excitement and fury than ever. Besides, they said, the garrison was discontented and depressed in spirit, and would make but a feeble resistance. It was composed mainly of troops brought in from the country, away from their families and homes, and all that they desired was to be released from duty, in order that they might go and see what had become of their wives and children. The conditions accepted, terms of peace agreed upon. The emperor, in the end, adopted this counsel, and he sent a commissioner to the camp of Genghis Khan to ask on what terms peace could be made. Genghis Khan stated the conditions. They were very hard, but the emperor was compelled to submit to them. One of the stipulations was that Genghis Khan was to receive one of the Chinese princesses, a daughter of the late emperor Yangtze, to add to the number of his wives. There were also to be delivered to him, for slaves, 500 young boys and as many girls, 3,000 horses, a large quantity of silk, and an immense sum of money. As soon as these conditions were fulfilled, after dividing the slaves and the booty among the officers and soldiers of his army, Genghis Khan raised the siege and moved off to the northward. In respect to the captives that his soldiers had taken in the towns and villages, the women and children spoken of above, the army carried off with them all that were old enough to be of any value as slaves. The little children, who would only, they thought, be in the way, they massacred. The Emperor's uneasiness. Consultations. The Emperor was by no means easy after the Mongol army had gone. A marauding enemy like that, bought off by the payment of a ransom, is exceedingly apt to find some pretext for returning, and the Emperor did not feel that he was safe. Very soon after the Mongols had withdrawn, he proposed to his council the plan of removing his court southward to the other side of the Wang Ho, to a large city in the province of Henan. Some of his counselors made great objections to this proposal. They said that if the emperor withdrew in that manner from the northern provinces, that portion of his empire would be irretrievably lost. Genghis Khan would soon obtain complete and undisputed possession of the whole of it. The proper course to be adopted, they said, was to remain and make a firm stand in defense of the capital and of the country. They must levy new troops, repair the fortifications, recruit the garrison, and lay in supplies of food and other military stores, and thus prepare themselves for a vigorous and efficient resistance, in case the enemy should return. But the emperor could not be persuaded. He said that the treasury was exhausted, the troops were discouraged, the cities around the capital were destroyed, and the whole country was so depopulated by the devastations of the Mongols that no considerable number of fresh levies could be obtained, and that, consequently, the only safe course for the government to pursue was to retire to the southward, beyond the river. He would, however, he added, leave his son, with a strong garrison, to defend the capital. Abandonment of the capital. Revolt of the guards. He accordingly took with him a few favorites of his immediate family and a small body of troops, and commenced his journey, a journey which was considered by all the people as a base and ignoble flight. He involved himself in endless troubles by this step. A revolt broke out on the way among the guards who accompanied him. One of the generals who headed the revolt sent a messenger to Genghis Khan, informing him of the emperor's abandonment of his capital, and offering to go over, with all the troops under his command, to the service of Genghis Khan, if Genghis Khan would receive him. The siege of the capital renewed. When Genghis Khan heard thus of the retreat of the emperor from his capital, he was, or pretended to be, much incensed. He considered the proceeding as in some sense an act of hostility against himself, and as such an infraction of the treaty and a renewal of the war. So he immediately ordered one of his leading generals, a certain chieftain named Mingan, to proceed southward at the head of a large army and lay siege to Yang King again. The old emperor, who seems now to have lost all spirit and to have given himself up entirely to despondency and fear, was greatly alarmed for the safety of his son the prince, whom he had left in command at Yen King. He immediately sent orders to his son to leave the city and come to him. The departure of the prince, in obedience to these orders, of course threw an additional gloom over the city, and excited still more the general discontent which the emperor's conduct had awakened. Wan Yen and Man Yen, their perplexity. The prince, on his departure, left two generals in command of the garrison. Their names were Wan Yen and Man Yen. They were left to defend the city as well as they could from the army of Mongols under Mingan, which was now rapidly drawing near. The generals were greatly embarrassed and perplexed with the difficulties of their situation. The means of defense at their disposal were wholly inadequate and they knew not what to do. Suicide proposed. At length one of them, Wan Yen, proposed to the other that they should kill themselves. This Man Yen refused to do. Man Yen was the commander on whom the troops chiefly relied, and he considered suicide a mode of deserting one's post scarcely less dishonorable than any other. He said that his duty was to stand by his troops, and if he could not defend them where they were, to endeavor to draw them away, while there was an opportunity, to a place of safety. Wan Yen in despair. So Wan Yen, finding his proposal rejected, went away in a rage. He retired to his apartment and wrote a dispatch to the emperor, in which he explained the desperate condition of affairs and the impossibility of saving the city, and in the end declared himself deserving of death for not being able to accomplish the work which his majesty had assigned to him. He enveloped and sealed this dispatch, and then, calling his domestics together, he divided among them, in a very calm and composed manner, all his personal effects, and then took leave of them and dismissed them. His suicide. A single officer only now remained with him. In the presence of this officer, he wrote a few words and then sent him away. As soon as the officer had gone, he drank a cup of poison which he had previously ordered to be prepared for him, and in a few minutes was a lifeless corpse. Man Yen's plan. Petition of the wives. In the meantime, the other general, Man Yen, had been making preparations to leave the city. His plan was to take with him such troops as might be serviceable to the emperor, but to leave all the inmates of the palace, as well as the inhabitants of the city, to their fate. Among the people of the palace were, it seems, a number of the emperor's wives, whom he had left behind at the time of his own flight, he having taken with him, at that time, only a few of the more favored ones. These women who were left, when they heard that Man Yen was intending to abandon the city with a view of joining the emperor in the south, came to him in a body and begged him to take them with him. Sacking of the city by Mingan. In order to relieve himself of their solicitations, he said that he would do so, but he added that he must leave the city himself with the guards to prepare the way, and that he would return immediately for them. They were satisfied with this promise and returned to the palace to prepare for the journey. Man Yen at once left the city, and very soon after he had gone, Mingan, the Mongol general, arrived at the gates, and meeting with no effectual resistance, he easily forced his way in, and a scene of universal terror and confusion ensued. The soldiers spread themselves over the city in search of plunder, and killed all who came in their way. They plundered the palace and then set it on fire. So extensive was the edifice and so vast were the stores of clothing and other valuables which it contained, even after all the treasures which could be made available to the conquerors had been taken away, that the fire continued to burn among the ruins for a month or more. Massacres. What became of the unhappy women who were so cruelly deceived by Man Yen in respect to their hopes of escape, does not directly appear. They doubtless perished with the other inhabitants of the city in the general massacre. Soldiers at such a time, while engaged in the sack and plunder of a city, are always excited to a species of insane fury, and take a savage delight in thrusting their pikes into all that come in their way. Fate of Man Yen. Man Yen excused himself, when he arrived at the quarters of the emperor, for having thus abandoned the women to their fate, by the alleged impossibility of saving them. He could not have succeeded, he said, in effecting his own retreat and that of the troops who went with him, if he had been encumbered in his movements by such a company of women. The emperor accepted this excuse and seemed to be satisfied with it, though not long afterward, Man Yen was accused of conspiracy against the emperor and was put to death. Treasures. Mingan took possession of the imperial treasury, where he found great stores of silk and also of gold and silver plate. All these things he sent to Genghis Khan, who remained still at the north at a grand encampment which he had made in Tartary. Conquests extended. Governors appointed. After this, other campaigns were fought by Genghis Khan in China, in the course of which he extended his conquests still farther to the southward and made himself master of a very great extent of country. After confirming these conquests, he selected from among such Chinese officers as were disposed to enter into his service suitable persons to be appointed governors of the provinces, and in this way annexed them to his dominions. These officers, thus transferring their allegiance from the emperor to him, and covenanting to send to him the tribute which they should annually collect from their respective dominions. Everything being thus settled in this quarter, Genghis Khan next turned his attention to the western frontiers of his empire, where the Tartar and Mongol territory bordered on Turkestan and the dominions of the Mohammedans. End of chapter 16.
Ladies and gentlemen, join us again next week for a continuation of Radio Lilouette's special presentation of Jacob Abbott's Genghis Khan.